From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what the partial government shutdown means for those who rely on food assistance benefits.
We have to let families know they're going to be okay for now, but if this goes on longer, they're not going to be okay.
And the impact on the Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore.
People have been pretty conscientious about taking care of the park.
Millions of trees killed by the emerald ash borer. We meet the Michigan man on a mission to warn us about all those dead trees.
I don't want to see anybody killed or injured or lose any property on account of an ash tree falling on them unexpectedly.
And theater talk.
This is a new play about a pair of twin sisters who are geneticists, and they have a plan to feminize the world.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello there, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The partial government shutdown is in its 25th day with no resolution in sight to the impasse between President Trump and congressional Democrats over funding for Trump's border wall. What does the shutdown mean for people who rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, more commonly known as food stamps? 1.2 million Michigan residents rely on those SNAP benefits to buy food. Let's get the latest now as we welcome Gilda Jacobs, president and CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy. Gilda, where do things stand right now for these people with SNAP benefits?
Well, right now, we're okay. In fact, the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services actually issued a statement today to let folks know that Michigan will start issuing the February benefits on Saturday, January the 19th. So, as you said, there's 1.2 million Michigan residents who get food assistance. They will have benefits in February, even if the partial federal government shutdown continues. So that's good news. I think what's unfortunate is the anxiety and the angst that so many families are going through right now is very serious. You know, we have to let families know they're going to be okay for now, but if this goes on longer, they're not going to be okay. And then, you know, we have the local nonprofits and the faith community that may be out there, but the things that they've budgeted for emergencies were never the funds or the food are not budgeted for a man-made, D.C.-made crisis or emergency for other kinds of emergencies. So
and
it's not a good thing.
Yeah, when you stop. So you've got this workaround at least, so people know that they'll have their February benefits. But when you say they're going to start getting those benefits Saturday, how much earlier is that than usual?
It is a couple of weeks earlier. And the department also says people really need to budget the funds that they are receiving in January. So if they need to have their food needs met for the month of February, they'll be able to budget for that.
So, yeah, I can hear it loud and clear. You're going to get like a large benefit, but you got to make it last because there won't be anything there if this shutdown continues.
Exactly.
And what about when let's just say this continues and drags on. When you worry about this at night, what do you think about for these people in Michigan who rely on these SNAP benefits? What do you see happening to them?
I mean, I think it is really a shame that they have become pawns in a political gamesmanship that's going on in D.C. This is not who we should be as a country. I'm very angry. I am very upset. And as I said, the emergency food programs that are out there are not meant for this type of crisis that is totally man-made. You know, it's meant for if you lose your job suddenly, or there's a fire, or there's a sudden downturn in the economy, or you lose your job. It's not because people in D.C. are digging their heels in. Believe me, I don't think President Trump, quite honestly, has never gone a day without a meal. And I just really feel that the people that are affected by this aren't really being taken into consideration as human beings in this chess game that's going on.
And we're hearing stories from all corners of the country of federal workers who are furloughed, who are not getting paid, who are maybe reporting to work, no paychecks, turning to food banks for help, which leads me to wonder, how about people who are trying to sign up for SNAP benefits right now? Does the shutdown affect that, Gilda?
Honestly, I really am not sure. Plus, we have an asset test on food assistance. I would hope that that asset test, which we hope will be eliminated with the new administration, that that asset test doesn't go for government workers who are now faced with payless paydays who have to put food on the table. So that's actually something that I need to look up today. But, you know, I think what you raise is really, really important. The benefits that are available for people in our state and in our country are not just for people who are low income. They're for lots of different people that are having difficulty surviving from paycheck to paycheck, or who have to pay their rent, have to have a car, you know, paying their car payment. These are very, very real concerns for our federal workers in our state. We have close to 6,000 federal employees in our state. That's a lot of people who, some of them can't get a mortgage to, let's say, to buy a house. Maybe their credit rating is going to be hurt by all of this. So there's clearly a ripple effect of what's going on in D.C.
And one other quick query here, apart from the SNAP benefits, which we know go to individual families, the federal government also puts money behind school breakfasts and lunches and nutrition assistance for the Women, Infants, and Child program,
right.
The WIC program. Are we seeing any impact on those programs from the shutdown?
Right now, no. WIC will continue on without interruption through February. But, you know, then again, you know, what's going to happen after February if there is no movement that's made on this? This is not something that we should be proud of, that we're now in the longest shutdown ever that our government has ever gone through. So there's not unlimited assistance, you know, past February.
Gilda Jacobs, President, CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy. Gilda, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We wondered how the partial shutdown is affecting the Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore. So we called and...
Hello. Due to a lapse in funding of the federal government budget, I am out of the office. I am not authorized to work during this time, but will respond to your message when I return to the office.
So we were able to track down someone who is not on the government payroll because he's a volunteer. Kerry Kelly is chairman of the board of the Friends of Sleeping Bear Dunes. Kerry, to your knowledge, how many park employees are impacted by this partial shutdown?
During the winter months, generally they have approximately 50 employees at the Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore. And during at least the first part of the shutdown, to my knowledge, there were two law enforcement people on duty and one or two maintenance people that were kind of on call.
So what has that meant for the park? I'm wondering what is and what is not open to visitors right now.
Yeah, well, since the shutdown, all the hiking trails, the beach access points, the Sleeping Bear Heritage Trail, which is a 20-mile-long multi-use trail, all of those were open. Vault toilets at trailheads were open. What was closed primarily were the administrative offices and the visitor center.
And I understand that the Friends of Sleeping Bear Dunes has kind of stepped in to help care for the park during this shutdown. What work were you doing?
Well, first of all, we had an agreement with Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore just prior to the shutdown that allowed us to continue to operate during the shutdown. And the primary work that we were asked to do was to maintain the Sleeping Bear Heritage Trail, which we do normally all year long anyway. We also were maintaining the vault toilets throughout the park at trailheads and beach access points, and we're taking care of trash cans around the park.
And now we're hearing reports that the National Park Service has started using recreation fee revenue to kind of handle some of these maintenance tasks. What does that mean? Is your group off the hook now?
We are in terms of the vault toilets and the trash pickup. So they're going to be doing that. We'll continue to manage the Sleeping Bear Heritage Trail. And the other thing that is now available is if we get snow, the Park Service will plow the parking lots and driveways.
And Kerry, there's a very significant school outreach program that's being affected. Tell us about that.
That's right. We have a snowshoe program that we do with fourth graders around northern Michigan. Last year, we had approximately 25 schools and 1,400 fourth graders that came out to the park on a field trip, learned how to snowshoe, learned about the winter ecology, and identified trees and animal tracks and so forth. That program has been canceled for this year because of the government shutdown.
Loss for the kids and the idea of growing future fans of the park.
That's right. The other thing that has impacted us is this is the time of year when we do our planning for programs and projects that will be executed on in the spring and summer. So none of that planning is going on. None of the hiring of interns is going on. Normally, this is the time of year when we're talking to college interns and trying to set them up. And we normally have 10 to 15 college interns working for us in the summertime, and none of that interviewing is going on right now.
You know, Carrie, over the weekend, you probably saw the reports that people went to the Joshua Tree National Park in California. They went mm-hmm. into the wilderness. They set up illegal campsites. They were driving off-road. And then, gasp, even cut down Joshua trees to make new roads. Mm. What were your feelings when you heard those reports?
You know, it's just a tragedy that our national treasures, like our national parks, are being abused like that. Fortunately, here in Sleeping Bear Dunes, we don't have that problem, at least haven't so far. So you haven't had any problems with trash just being piling up around the trash containers or anything like that. People have been pretty conscientious about taking care of the park.
And I guess as you think ahead, there's certainly no sign that this partial shutdown, that the impasse is being settled between, you know, congressional Democrats and the president. Mm-hmm. What do you worry about if this keeps dragging on for the Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore?
Yeah, for us, wintertime is kind of our lighter time of the year relative to visitation. But if this drags on into the spring and summer, we're going to get into very large numbers of visitors coming to the park. And that's going to be overwhelming for a group of volunteers.
Carrie Kelly is the chairman of the board of the Friends of Sleeping Bear Dunes at the National Lakeshore. Thank you so very much for talking with us on Stateside, Carrie.
Thank you.
Up next, the latest in Alzheimer's disease research.
There are a couple of new medications out that appear to have some effect, which is very exciting.
That's up next. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Alzheimer's Association tells us some 5.7 million Americans have that debilitating disease. And get ready for this. By 2050, that number is expected to nearly triple to 16 million. Over the last year, a number of promising fronts have opened up in the research to combat this disease. And here to talk about some of them is Dr. Bruno Giordani. He is a professor of psychiatry, neurology, psychology, and nursing at the University of Michigan, where he's associate director of the Michigan Alzheimer's Disease Center. So, doctor, just to be clear, when we talk about Alzheimer's disease, are we talking about one type of dementia?
That's right.
Can we use the terms interchangeably as we talk through this about research, treatment, and diagnosis or not?
Well, I mean, most people do. The real idea is that dementia is sort of, they call it the umbrella term. So it covers all the kind of progressive dementia. So Alzheimer's disease, though, is about 75% of those. And you also have other really difficult disorders like frontal temporal disorder that affects the front part of the brain. You have Lewy body disease associated with Parkinson's, and you have a number of other disorders that are part of that other grouping. But because and vascular dementia, of course, too. But because so many of them often are comorbid with Alzheimer's, or Alzheimer's itself is the largest, that's why so many folks talk about Alzheimer's.
So when we think of, for example, stats for Michigan from the Alzheimer's mm-hmm. Association, yeah. which tells us right now about 180,000 Michiganders yep. over age 65 have it. And by 2025, which is not very far away, nope. it's going to be 220,000 and then up from there. So
right.
how hopeful is it?
Really, every year, the Alzheimer's Association has the largest sort of single conference for one disease. That's the Alzheimer's International Conference. That conference every year really sort of puts forward what's the latest information. And honestly, this one was hopeful in a number of ways. There are a lot of things going on that make it of real interest. There are a couple of new medications out that appear to have some effect, which is very exciting. And these are studies that are in the midst of clinical trials, but they've already finished some analyses for some, or sort of the initial trials have been done. And this is really the first time that anybody said that some of these drugs that attack amyloid in the brain.
So, and which is what?
So amyloid, Alzheimer's disease really really comes from basically the association between two things that naturally occur in the brain. One is amyloid. And amyloid can lay down in the brain 25, maybe more years before you even see a symptom. And this is really a byproduct of really sort of a mix-up in the system, it looks like. And these proteins don't clear from the brain, these sort of precursor proteins don't clear from the brain the way they used to, and they clump together in plaques.
So we're talking about a type of protein.
Yeah, and essentially then at the same time you have tau, which is sort of the thing that kind of cements those cells and their axons, the messenger pieces of those cells together. And eventually what starts to happen is maybe it's because of the amyloid, maybe it's because of some other process going on, but tau begins to release from the cells. The cells begin to fall apart and you see what are called tangles. So in 1901, when Dr. Alzheimer's identified the first patient with Alzheimer's, of course, we've had patients for Alzheimer's forever, but he sort of identified the first person, August Dieter, and looked in her brain, he saw plaques and tangles. He identified plaques and tangles, these sort of clumps of protein and these misshapen cells. Those are the key indicators of Alzheimer's.
So knowing that,
yeah.
Then that, I get, am I right that starts leading researchers to what do we do
exactly.
Medication-wise to slow
exactly.
this down
exactly.
or prevent?
Or prevent. But, you know, the problem has been, honestly, one of the big problems has been we only treat when the symptoms appear. But now that we understand that amyloid lays down years, decades potentially, before somebody ever really has symptoms, now we have other ways to look at treatment we never did before. And this is only in the past few years that this has been understood. I mean, we can use what's called a plaque buster. So identify that plaque, highlight that plaque so that the white cells, the cells of the brain itself meant to clear stuff up, go after that. We can develop ways to keep the tau in the cells. We can develop ways that sort of break up those enzymes and kind of find the right enzymes and push the right enzymes in that normally create this amyloid. So there's all sorts of ways to look at this down the pike now that we never really kind of had the ability to do till we really understood the disease.
So how far down the pike?
We're dealing with such a significant disorder that really, you know, we could have, as you say, by 2050, we could have 14 million people with this disorder, over 400 million worldwide. So this is a dramatic disorder. So there's a lot more panic now in terms of just let's prepare for it. One thing I have to say is that thanks to the Alzheimer's Association, we really have a push now in Congress. And President Obama, President Trump have signed legislation to increase significantly the budget in Alzheimer's. So I think that budget change has meant a huge difference. I mean, Alzheimer's research used to get $500 million a year in funding in 2014. Now we're up to $2.3 billion. We're still not at the level of cancer, heart, or HIV, but at least now there's recognition this is a disease where we have to do really solid research. Because of that, we have these new things. We have aducanumab. We have BAN2401, two brand new drugs that reported that they were showing if they reduce amyloid, even in patients who already have symptoms, there was an improvement in symptoms, and most important as well, there was a reduction in the amyloid in the brain.
So it could slow the progression.
And those two things, both the improvement in cognition and the change in amyloid related to the dose of the drug. So you have what's called a dosage effect. So you're pretty sure something's happening. So that's really exciting. I mean, a lot more research has to go on with those two drugs, but at least they knew that they could go on and look more carefully at these drugs. At the same time, we have exciting, and which is really exciting, and we'll probably hear news of the first one at the next AAIC. We have five studies at least going on that are called prevention trials.
I think so that's what people will perk up
with. Those are
the
things people are really interested in. So the prevention trials. So, for example, they are looking at folks in a set of them. They are looking at folks who have early onset. So these are – it's a very small percentage of individuals, only about 200,000 people who have early onset. That means they get this disease in their 30s, 40s, 50s. But the thing about that is when they get it that early, they don't have all those other things the rest of us have, like diabetes, heart disease, and other things. And the other thing about early onset is if you're going to get that disease, you're going to get it about 5 years plus or minus when your parent did. So now we know, okay, if you can take these folks, they have amyloid in the brain. We know about when they're going to develop it. If you give them medication and it slows the appearance or it doesn't appear, now we're really talking about something. So those are the Alzheimer's Association has collected people from around the world who had early onset families. They bring them every year, even now, to the AAIC meeting so they can see the research going on. In Medellin, Colombia, there is a small village that has an extremely high rate of familial onset. Even those individuals are taking part in drug trials. And then at the same time, there's a couple of trials looking at ApoE interactions, people who carry the ApoE gene and have a family history. There's another gene called TOM that seems to be TOMM that seems to be associated. So there are a number of trials going on that are really trying to do early identification. There's another critically important trial called the A4 study that basically says, look, if you're over 65 and this is a trial we've been doing, if you're over 65 and you feel like you don't have memory problems, we'll test you, see that you don't have memory problems, and we will give you an amyloid scan.
Ah, to get those early signs.
To see if you have early signs.
Not too dissimilar than, for example, a mammogram.
Exactly. I mean, the whole point of this is, look, we now have, over the past couple of years, we can now image amyloid, and now we can even image tau. So we can image the two basic components of this disease. So now you have incredible markers. You have amyloid, which is early risk, and you have tau, which remember I said it starts to appear as the symptoms appear. So you can look at biological symptoms of this disease, something we haven't been able to do.
Should we argue that screening should be it could be a cost saver, that insurance should cover widespread screening, the way we push women to have mammograms?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of discussion about that. The biggest piece of the discussion is that an amyloid scan is very expensive. And if you do an amyloid and tau scan, you're in the $15,000 range. So that's clearly not going to happen with screening. But what if we knew the ways to get people in for that screening early? So that's where a lot of the research. We have finished one study. We have another large study going on in Detroit where we are looking at individuals, African Americans in this case, who may have some mild complaints but are genuinely normal. And we're looking at both computerized testing over time to see if we can see any change, as well as EEG, electroencephalography. Maybe if we look at some of these other techniques we've had for a long time, we may be able to find tipping points when healthy individuals should get that scanning. A lot of work in blood as well, right?
Right.
We still don't have any blood markers, but there's a lot of research going on here at Michigan, a lot of research going on around the country looking at blood-based markers.
So if you were to think of a spectrum, one being the dark ages, knowing nothing about what's causing this dementia, and number 10 being we know what it is, we can treat it, we can even prevent it, where would you say we are on that scale?
Well, I'll tell you what, your scale is a little bit skewed, and
okay.
I should tell you that, because remember I said 1901, Dr. Alzheimer said, boink. So Dr. Alzheimer's found this, described it. Kreplin came along and said, oh, yeah, look, here's a poor, because the problem was, or the unfortunate thing for her was, she had early onset. So everybody said, oh, maybe this is pre-senile dementia. So we're seeing young people get this terrible disease that we know everybody gets when they get old. And that was the problem. This is not what everybody gets when they get old. So in the 1970s and 80s when I was working as, I'm sure, an elementary school child, not, but when I was working in the 1970s and 1980s at Mount Sinai in New York, we were really interested in Alzheimer's as if it was not that common a disorder. Now we know really what we're looking at. But remember, this disorder that was identified, people were beginning to do research on it, didn't have its first diagnostic criteria till 1984. So not until 1984 did somebody say, okay, if you're a doctor, here's how you diagnose it. These are the symptoms you look for. Now we've had a new diagnostic criteria and a brand new discussion of a diagnostic criteria going on now. Really, those things hadn't happened. The other thing we have now is a diagnostic criteria for mild cognitive impairment, because we now recognize that as these symptoms first develop, we may be able to catch them perhaps early. So now we have a diagnosis that says, look, we understand that somebody has changed in their symptoms. They are having some mild problems, not interfering with life. Let's do that. But all this stuff now, and then these would be individuals we should treat first. But the whole idea, all this stuff didn't start happening until 1980s, 1990s. So it's skewed. So there's an incredible amount going on now. And, you know, the government has mandated, sort of, the government has hopefully mandated that by 2025, we'll have a cure or we'll be able to slow the progression. Remember, this is the only disease that you cannot prevent, slow the progression, or cure. So the thought is by 2025, hopefully, at least we'll have one of those ticks off the block.
And when you think about the pressure of the baby boom generation just moving along and what that's going to do, and I guess people who want to have any sense of maybe what they can do lifestyle-wise, any changes can people make now? Would the Alzheimer's Association website be a good place for people to get information about that?
Sure. The Alzheimer's Association website has a lot of that. NIH.gov does. But honestly, it's easy just to go to the Alzheimer's Association website and get that information. The Michigan Great Lakes chapter, the Detroit chapter, the Toledo chapter, all three of those that our center works with all have that information. Our center website has all that information as well. Any of these places, folks can get that early information. And it's important because the other thing that came out of probably as I've gone to all of these from the beginning, these AAIC meetings, and it's not because every other year they're in an attractive European place, but the point is that as I've watched these develop, you've watched the whole idea of Alzheimer's treatment change. Early on, it was all about laboratory-based. Then imaging began to be included and people got interested. And now there's a lot more information, a lot more studies related to caregivers, for one, as well as how to potentially what can you and I do. And that's the key, because if this pill doesn't come along so fast or multiple pills don't come along so fast, we need to do something ourselves. If you look at what's going on now, all these new treatments are all aimed at what can you do as a person. So there is a set of studies called the FINGER trials that are going on around the world, and the POINTER study in the United States is going on, all linked by the Alzheimer's Association. All are about lifestyle. If you take care of your health, if you exercise, if you maintain a good diet, and if you exercise your brain, can we reduce the onset? And all of that is beginning to have some very interesting early information. The last one that came out at this meeting was the Sprint Mind study, which pointed out good cardiovascular health really makes a difference.
Dr. Bruno Giordani is Associate Director of the University of Michigan's Alzheimer's Disease Center. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Happy to do that.
just time for our friendly reminder. We love to hear from you and find out what stories are you focused on? What issues do you want to know more about? Just let us know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Michigan Radio. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And as always, MichiganRadio.org, and click the link that says Stateside. Coming up, the emerald ash borer has killed millions of trees, and those dead trees have become a hazard.
I cut the ones along the road in 2015 because I realized they could fall in the road and hurt someone.
We'll talk with a man who's made it his mission to map the location of potentially dangerous dead trees across Cass County, plus the latest on professional theater happenings around our state.
This is a new play about a pair of twin sisters who are geneticists, and they have a plan to feminize the world.
Stay tuned. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it's time for Theater Talk. Critic David Kiley of Encore Michigan is with us now to take us through some of the offerings from professional theater companies around our state. So here we are in the midway point of the theater season.
That's right. We start June 1st and go to May 31st. That's our cycle for the Wild Awards that we judge the season on. So,
all right. And it looks like we are starting today at the Detroit Rep.
Yes, they opened this past weekend with a play called The House on Poe Street. This is a new play about a pair of twin sisters who are geneticists, and they have a plan to feminize the world.
Okay.
there's a bit of science fiction going on here. It seems that they think the quote, this is a quote from the play, less men equals less violence. Now, I quibble with the grammar, as you would,
yes.
as fewer men equals less violence.
But it doesn't sound as good.
No, you get the idea.
Yeah.
And the title stems from the fact that they actually live in the house where Edgar Allan Poe wrote The Raven. And so it's pretty interesting, and it also really taps into the women's movement and everything that seems to be going on. I'd also like to mention that the show is directed by Leah Smith, who has been identified as by the theater's founder, Bruce Millen, as the next artistic and executive director of the theater. This is a big deal because Bruce has been the artistic director. He's a founder since the 1950s.
Boy, so this is a passing of the torch in an important way.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
All right, now we head up north to Waterford Township in the Monster Box Theater.
Yeah, they are doing 2 one-act plays for the price of one ticket.
Fun.
So one of the plays is Tom Stoppard's The Real Inspector Hound. And Stoppard wrote this play off his own experiences as a theater critic in England in the 1950s and early 60s. And the story, it's a farce, really, focuses on two critics who are reviewing a play that is based on Agatha Christie's Mousetrap, You know, it's a bit of a shaggy dog whodunit. And the critics become unexpectedly involved in the play in a way that they could not have imagined when they sat down. It's a lot of fun. It's farcical. So the other play on the bill is also very funny. It's called Black Comedy by Peter Schaefer. And this is a play about a sculptor and his debutante fiancée. And they borrowed some expensive antique furniture from his neighbor without his permission. And there's a power outage. And the really interesting thing about this play is that the action takes place as if they're in the dark. So it's kind of funny. It opens up in the dark and you're wondering what's going on here. But then when the power goes out, that's when the lights come up, and so they're sort of groping around for the rest of the play. It's very funny.
And again, back to British farce.
Yes, British
farce. And a little different from what Peter Schaefer's Equus.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. Over to the Ringwald in Ferndale, so we're heading down Woodward to 9 Mile. What's being done there?
They are doing a play called Significant Other by Joshua Harmon. I saw this the other night. It's very much rooted in millennial life. It's about four friends in their late 20s, three straight women, one gay man. And the man is, you know, he's the best bud. He's the non-sexual bestie they all feel safe with as they explore how they're going to sort out their romantic lives. And as each woman gets married, one after the other, the gay friend's still looking for his love connection. He feels like the odd man out. The acting, superb. The story will feel very relevant, I think, for younger theater goers. And I say younger because, you know, when I go to 70 shows a year, at least, and I see the average age patron as being about late 50s, frankly. Very few under the age of 30. This is the sort of play that I think will really appeal to people under 30.
Very good. All right. And there's always interesting work being done in Northville at the Tipping Point.
Yeah. Well, there again, this is sort of another play that I think appeals to younger folks. They're getting ready to open up the musical The Last 5 Years. And this is by Jason Robert Brown, the same composer who wrote the score for Bridges of Madison County, about two people, men and women, breaking up. And they tell the story through song, each from their own point of view, of the previous 5 year narrative that led to their drift apart and their ultimate split. This play gets done quite a bit because it does tend to attract younger patrons, and it's very popular with younger artistic directors.
Well, let's take a listen to a sample from the original cast recording of The Last 5 Years.
I think we both can see what could be better. I'll own when I was wrong. With all we've had to go through, we'll end up twice as strong. And so we'll start again this weekend. Just keep rolling along.
Very, very nice. And again, getting younger audiences in there and giving them the theater habit is essential. You want to build those audiences.
Yes, it's. I do think that as people get older, they tend to have more disposable income, mm-hmm. more time. And so even if they're not going a lot now, they tend to go later. That's been kind of the cycle.
All right. And speaking of some disposable income, a little bit different setting, the Fisher in Detroit, Rent.
Yeah, we teased this a bit in December, yes. But it's worth teasing again. They've opened this week. It's a terrific touring production of Rent, the 1990s musical based on La Boheme, about people struggling on the Lower East Side of Manhattan at the time of the AIDS crisis.
Yes, indeed. And the Meadowbrook, now that Christmas Carol is done, dusted, and packed away for another year, which, by the way, on your recommendation, I saw, and it was fantastic.
It is. It's amazing.
Indeed. So what's new at Meadowbrook?
Well, they have a play coming on called Fox on the Fairway, which is another romp, kind of like the Stoppard play we talked about. It's a story that undercuts the stuffy members of a private country club, has mistaken identities, romantic humor. It's a doors comedy, a lot of opening and closing doors. And I love a good doors comedy about a guy who really loves golf above all else.
Okay. So fun. Well, lots of good theater, and you'll get details on these and all kinds of other theater offerings around the state. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Cynthia.
For a little bitty beetle, the emerald ash borer sure has caused some big problems. Since the emerald ash borer first turned up in southeast Michigan in 2002, it has been found in 35 states, the District of Columbia, 5 Canadian provinces, and it has killed millions and millions of ash trees. Ron Gugger is on a mission to make sure we recognize the dangers of these dead ash trees. Ron lives on 26 acres of woodland in Cass County. And Ron Gugger, you're so worried about this, you've built a website called Dead Ash Trees Killing People. Why is this such an important cause for you?
Well, I don't want to see anybody killed or injured or lose any property on account of an ash tree falling on them unexpectedly.
And this kind of struck home for you, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I knew about the ash borer problem for quite a while because of the ones on my property. They started dying in 2010, and I cut the ones along the road in 2015 because I realized they could fall in the road and hurt someone. So then, last year in March, My wife topped a hill, and there was a big dead ash lying across both lanes right in front of her, and she could not stop because it was behind the hill where she couldn't see it. And she hit it and totaled the vehicle. Fortunately, no one was injured.
But that's not always the case, as I saw looking on your website that you've put together. There have been some pretty terrible tragedies because of these dead trees.
Absolutely, absolutely. I got thinking about that after her accident. And, well, before I started searching, there had been an incident here in Cass County where a 16-year-old boy, Nicholas Hewitt, was killed. And I heard that in the news, and I wondered at the time if that was maybe an ash tree. And after this happened to my wife, I drove over to the accident site, and I was able to confirm that it was indeed an ash tree, and a large one, that had fallen on that truck. And so then I started searching the Internet, and they were there, just as I feared they probably would be, quite a few of them.
Yeah, in fact, as I was kind of looking in and researching this to talk with you, you're right. You start Googling that and you see a lot of accidents where somebody's driving along and then a dead ash tree falls on that vehicle. And you are actually, as you say, you've cleared away trees from your 26 acres. How many do you think you've cleared away?
Oh, hundreds of them back on the property. But along the road, I would say there were a half a dozen. And I cleared the ones on the opposite side of the road for my neighbor as well. She's an elderly lady and couldn't do it. She had a monster tree over there. As a matter of fact, a county road commission guy was driving by when I was doing that, and he stopped and stayed there watching me until he made sure that tree was not going to fall across the road.
Now, as you do this research, and I'm going to, you know, preface this by saying I don't believe you're a lawyer, right?
No.
But what have you heard as you've researched this? Let's say that I own property with a dead tree near the roadside. What do you understand as far as what happens and who's liable if that tree falls?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm a pretty smart guy, and I did a tremendous amount of research on this. And everything, including the attorneys that I've talked to, says that the landowner is liable. And the County Road Commission is not. Even if it's on the right-of-way, the landowner's liable, and they can be sued for damages.
Now, I got to ask you, does a dead ash tree always look dead? I mean, could we be fooled by a tree that appears to be healthy, but inside it's actually dead?
Not in this case. That's why this issue needs to be brought to the public's attention, because you can easily recognize that it's a dead ash tree.
How do you know?
Well, at this point, a lot of the ones have lost the bark on the main trunk. And even if they haven't, they've started shedding the smaller limbs. A lot of times there'll be small limbs lying all around a larger tree because they break off first.
So they're not looking healthy.
Oh, absolutely. They're unmistakable.
So what are you calling on people to do, to know, to understand, and to do in order to reduce the risk from dead ash trees?
Well, obviously, to inspect their roadside properties and first see if they have any dead ash, and then, obviously, take steps to remove them before they fall on someone.
Ron, is there anything that drivers should be aware of, or any way that people should change their driving habits to kind of minimize the risk of being, you know, hit by a falling ash tree?
Well, certainly, if you know where they are, and in Cass County, that's easy to find out because of the Google Earth overlay that I built. I marked over 1,100 trees in this county. And now that I know where they are, I have absolutely changed my routing.
And so you've done that for Cass County. Do you have any sense whether people have done that for any other counties?
I'm sure they have not. I've got a blurb on my site asking people to contact me if they would like to do this for their county. And, of course, it's not just Michigan. It's the entire eastern seaboard. And there's no possible way I could do it all myself.
Absolutely. But a man on a mission, Ron Goodyear, who lives in Cass County, where he owns 26 acres of woodland and has become acutely aware of the problem of dead ash trees thanks to the emerald ash borer. Ron, thank you so much for getting the safety word out to everyone.
You're welcome, and thanks for your help.
Making art can be a fantastic hobby. It can be a fantastic career. And making art can be even deeper than that. It can be healing, build confidence. It can shape communities. We continue our series, Creating Connection, featuring very personal stories from Michiganders about how local arts programs have changed their lives. Today, the organization Girls Rock Detroit and the story of a young teen who discovered that she likes being loud every once in a while.
Hello, hello. Welcome to Girls Rock Detroit.
My name is Penny. I'm 13 years old, and I've been coming to Girls Rock Detroit for 4 years.
Are y'all excited? Getting hyped?
It's a five-day long camp where girls get to learn instruments, but also learn about empowering themselves and just learning about who they are. And they get to form a band and play a show at the end of the week. I was put in a band with completely new people. I didn't know anybody. We actually kind of chose a silly name. It was the Seven Bold Banana Slugs. We each kind of chose something that we liked and put it together. I chose Banana Slugs. I had been playing the acoustic guitar for about a year or two, but I never played the electric guitar before. It was just a completely new experience for me, because when I was playing the acoustic guitar, you had all of these rules and they didn't want you to play like you played the electric guitar, and I actually liked it better. You could just be louder and wilder. It was just more free. Sometimes I get more shy around boys because it's just the way that I am, so I feel like this does make kind of a space where girls can be girls. We had this workshop where we would write about how we felt when women were harassed and things like that. That was fun for me because I like to write. And I found out that you could write songs that were about how you felt inside, that you could really express yourself.
Don't squeeze me, don't pick me up, don't get mad when I tell you to stop.
There were a couple of incidents at my school, just boys being boys, and I got tired of that. Because I'm small, people like to pick me up, so I don't like that. I would tell them that I didn't like it, and when they didn't listen, I wrote a poem. It's called Try Me, and my band decided to use it as the lyrics for the song.
Don't hug me, don't pull my hair, don't try to make me laugh, you're just still there.
On the day of the showcase, I changed some of my clothes to make them look more punk rock.
And you are just a boy.
I feel really excited to go on stage and perform for all these people. And I'm never that nervous because I feel like if somebody's going to judge us, that's their problem. My guitar makes me feel safer, almost.
I'm not your baby, I'm not your toy, I'm not an object, and you are just a boy.
It makes me feel powerful and angry sometimes, but strong that I could do that. And it has given me more confidence. I find it cool that sometimes I can be really loud.
Try me!
And that was the voice of Penny, a 13-year-old Michigander discovering her inner rock star at Girls Rock Detroit. Our Creating Connection series was produced by Elizabeth Meister and Dan Collison at Long Haul Productions and funded by the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, and Bella Isaacs. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.